Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Retro Rankings podcast, where, hey, we're getting back into the swing of video game things with today's episode. I kind of missed doing this. The last two episodes fell in the month of Halloween, including the 10th Storytime episode that we have called DLC Packs. So I did a little ghost story. If you haven't heard, that would be episode 10, ghost stories actually. And episode 11 was the top 7 Halloween franchise film movies with TJ of Potation Rotation. But we are back talking video games on this 12th edition of the Retro Rankings podcast. And let me tell you something, I am drinking a very cherry flavored Jelly Belly sparkling water today, just because I'm alcoholed out. Let me tell you why I'm alcoholed out. What's been going on? So I just got back from a small mini vacation. I took a trip with the fam to Door County. It was the third time in Door County this year. I think it's a new record for me. Did 2 days of wine tasting, some day drinking, some night drinking as well. Got some of my cherry pie in. So I've had plenty to drink in recent days. So therefore, I'm sticking with the water today. But it was a good trip. Came back with a case full of wine, a cherry pie, and we also stopped at Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant for breakfast 2 days in a row. I ended up getting their Swedish pancake mix and some lingonberries and some Swedish pancake syrup. It was a good trip. Good trip. That's what I was doing in my spare time before sitting down and getting back into the swing of things. And what else is going on video game related? The new Mario Party game dropped recently. Is it everything everyone was hoping for out of a Mario Party game? Did Nintendo redeem themselves? I don't know. I haven't actually played it yet. Been playing other things instead. I did finish Metroid Dread. I enjoyed the game overall. I thought it was hard at times, like kind of in unfair territory. But like past Metroid entries, that's kind of what it is. You need to figure things out. You need to memorize patterns. You need to make sure that you know what you're doing with the controls in order to succeed through said patterns. But there was just times where it just seemed just totally unfair, especially with trying to figure out how to kill some of the Emmys. And you know, it was intense at times. It made me get anxiety. I did rage quit a few times as well, but I did 100% it on normal mode, and I did, unlock the gallery for that. I'm not playing it like the other 6 times. I think there was like five or six. A couple of other timed plays with the normal mode, and then 100%ing hard mode and some other time plays on hard mode unlock the rest of the gallery. No fucking way. I'm done. I'm done. It was, like I said, overall, it was a good game. It looks, graphically, it looks fantastic. You can just put that 2D side-scrolling shit to rest, because it's like a hybrid, and you very much don't, it doesn't feel like a 2D side-scrolling game once you really start getting into it. But it was just missing something. It was missing something that past Metroid games had, the original Metroid, Super Metroid, Metroid Fusion even. There was something missing. I wouldn't say like a warmth, but the fact that Metroid Dread kind of seemed cold to me, that's the only thing I could say, is it was missing some kind of Metroid warmth. But I enjoyed my 18 hours I put into it, because that's what I do. I take my time. take my time with games, get my money's worth out of them. 18 hours, 100% completion. And most of that is because I went back several times to try to, you know, throughout the map to try to ammo up the best I can and then go forward and then, you know, unlock some things. And, you know, when I gain a new ability to unlock said things, I would go back again. I must have went back and retreaded the game three times. Or some people will just get as far as they can and have all the, you know, collectible weapons at their stead, and then they'll go back and retread and collect everything that they couldn't get, everything that they couldn't unlock before, and then finish the game. I didn't do that. I chose to try to power up as early and as often as I could. Other than that, since I got back, I'm excited. I want to play that Guardians of the Galaxy game. So, yeah, I came back from vacation, and now I'm getting caught up. I'm getting caught up on all the video game stuff that I missed. I had to finish Spirit Tracks for this episode because I put it down, and I didn't finish it for months. And, you know, got that done, got that in. Here we are recording this episode. This is it. Let's get right into it because it's going to be a long one. I'm the only one doing this, but it's still going to be pretty long. Try to refine it as I try to improve the podcast. There's going to be a brand new method of me presenting my listings, and hopefully it'll be nice and clean and precise, and it leaves a lot of my rambling out because God knows I edit a lot of that shit out anyway, and that way I say a lot, and so with pauses and also and I edit a lot of that out. So hopefully being a little bit more precise in my presentation as I try to improve as I go along here. Let's see how well this works. This is today's episode. It is the top 7 The Legend of Zelda handheld titles of all time. So, yeah, I'm kind of just starting to wrap up my own Zelda 35th anniversary this year. This is one of the last two things I got to do, this podcast, this episode of this podcast. And then we've got the Game & Watch coming out, so that review will be on YouTube as well. But let's get right into it. 7. 4 Swords. Originally released in December 2002 in North America and March 2003 in Japan and Europe, The Legend of Zelda: Four Swords is the 9th main installment of the Legend of Zelda series. Released alongside A Link to the Past for the Game Boy Advance as a package known as A Link to the Past and Four Swords. It was the first multiplayer The Legend of Zelda game to be released, requiring 2 2-4 Game Boy Advance systems with a copy of the game to be linked up. It is the first in the Four Swords series, and the game introduced Vati as a new main boss for the franchise. As part of the 25th anniversary, 10 years ago, of the Zelda series, an enhanced port of the game was released for the Nintendo DSi and Nintendo 3DS, which is the version I played. The only version a single player can play using 2 links, by the way. It was a limited time free download called Four Swords Anniversary Edition, and thankfully, I still have a 3DS with a lot of old shit on it, so I lucked out. Actually, it's been a while since I played it. I did start playing it when it came out. Side note, I did start playing it when it came out. I never finished it, so I had to pick it back up for the sole purposes of this podcast.
What the hell is wrong with you?
The game was developed by Nintendo EAD and Capcom, directed by Yoichi Yamada and Harimaro Fujibayashi, and produced by Takashi Tezuka, Noritaka Funamizu, and Katsuhiro Sudo. Music was composed by Yuko Takahara. The story. Taking place before the events of Ocarina of Time, the prologue shows Link and Zelda approaching a sword in a pedestal called the Four Sword. After Zelda explains its history and the creature sealed within it, the creature named Vadi breaks free, capturing Zelda to marry her. Link is encountered by the three fairies who instruct Link to pull the Four Sword out. Link removes the sword, inadvertently creating three copies of himself that fight alongside him. As the game begins, the four Links are tasked with finding four great fairies, who together will grant them access to Vadi's palace. After finding the four great fairies and entering the palace, the Links battle Vadi. After Vadi is thoroughly weakened, he is trapped in the Four Sword. Zelda and Link return the Four Sword back to its pedestal. This game falls under the Force era within the Hylia and the Hero of Time timeline. The gameplay. Four Swords has many features not seen in other The Legend of Zelda series games. The original release requires at least two people to play with four Links and uses randomly generated dungeons. The edition I played is single player with two Links. Floors of stages are made of two parts. These two parts are randomly interchanged to produce random floors. To move about and onto the next floor of a stage, all the Links must reach a warp zone. The faster they reach the warp zone, the bigger the rupee bonus. After clearing two floors, or nine floors if clearing Vadi's palace with the hero keys, the Links will be warped to a boss room. After defeating a boss, except for Vadi, a great fairy will appear. Depending upon the number of rupees collected, they will give the Links either a silver key, a gold key, a hero key, or in some cases, no key at all. The Link who did the best in a stage will receive a Medal of Courage. These medals are needed to acquire certain items and a technique in A Link to the Past. The number of players playing the game, as well as which epic they are playing through, affects the type of random areas and items that will appear during a playthrough. When a Link loses all his hearts, he will be downed. A Link is incapable of moving while down until he pays a penalty of rupees to be revived. The first revival costs 50 rupees, but the amount needed increases by another 50 each time Link is downed. The maximum cost of a revival is 500 rupees. If Link does not have enough rupees to be revived, the game ends. If all Links have filled all their heart containers, any rupees a Link finds will be worth twice its normal value. What are the pros of Four Swords? It's got an updated map screen and new stages added to the Anniversary Edition that I played. That's a good pro. It retains the look of A Link to the Past, but also seems to update the graphics for a cleaner and crisper look. It provides gameplay based on multiple Zelda titles. Those include The Legend of Zelda, The Legend of Zelda A Link to the Past, and Link's Awakening. It's also got a pretty good soundtrack. Now, what are the cons of this game? The new stages in the Anniversary Edition are not randomized like the originals are. Controls can be somewhat disorienting, switching between the two Links, and it takes some getting used to. The same could be said if you're playing two players with four Links. Added some Wind Waker design elements to piggyback off the also recently released console title of the same name. Mixing the two visual styles of ALTTP and WW is an odd artistic decision. That's my opinion, not just my personal analysis. It really does not detract from the overall gameplay. It can be difficult to play currently. This is the last con, especially the original release with finding enough friends with GBAs, the cables, and each one has to have a copy of the game. If you can somehow find the Anniversary Edition ROM, I suggest that's probably the best way to go, especially for a single-player campaign. All right. So, that's how that goes. Number 7 is Four Swords.
6.
Phantom Hourglass. Originally released in Japan in June 2007 and North America, Australia, and Europe in October 2007, The Legend of Zelda Phantom Hourglass is the 14th main installment of the Legend of Zelda series. It is the first The Legend of Zelda game for the Nintendo DS in a direct sequel to The Wind Waker. The development team for Phantom Hourglass has many returning developers from Four Sword Adventures. I always say Four Sword Adventures. It's Four Swords Adventures. It's just that S and that A just don't roll together. They like butt heads. Four Swords Adventures. God damn it. many of whom, in turn, were chosen from those who worked on A Link to the Past. The game was developed by Nintendo EAD, directed by Daki Awamoto, produced by Eiji Aonuma, and music was composed by Kenta Nagata and Toru Minegishi. Story. Some time after Wind Waker, Phantom Hourglass opens with Tetra and her pirate crew, along with Link, chasing down a ghost ship claimed to have taken sailors and residents of the local islands. The crew discovers the ship, but when Tetra goes aboard to explore, she disappears. Link attempts to follow her, but ends up adrift in the ocean. Link later recovers through the help of the fairy Saila, who has some amnesia about her past, and an old man named Oshus, who help Link on his quest to find the ghost ship and reunite with Tetra. To that end, they enlist the help of the reluctant Captain Linebeck and his ship after saving him from the Temple of the Ocean King. Linebeck only offers to help with the expectation of finding treasure along the way. Link discovers that to learn of the ghost ship's position, they must find the Spirits of Courage, Wisdom, and Power using maps and clues hidden in the Temple of the Ocean King. However, to overcome the evil forces of the temple, Link must make use of the Sands of Hours within the Phantom Hourglass and possessed by other creatures around the island to prevent his life force from being drained. With the aid of the Hourglass, Link can locate and ally with the Spirits of Wisdom and Power easily, but the Spirit of Courage he finds looks exactly like Saila. Oshus explains that Saila is the Spirit of Courage, and she lost her memory when Bellum attacked her. He also reveals that he himself is the Ocean King. Oshus further explains that he and Saila had to take their present forms to hide from the life-eating monster Bellum, who is the cause of the ghost ship and other evil in the local area and has taken residence at the very depths of the temple. Link succeeds in his attempt to rescue Tetra with the help of three spirits, but finds Tetra is now a statue, a further effect of Bellum's life-draining power. Link is ready to continue, but Linebeck initially refuses to help further, having come up empty-handed for treasure so far, though agrees to continue once Oshus promises to grant Linebeck one wish after Link's quest is complete. This game falls within the adult timeline. Gameplay. Phantom Hourglass is an action-adventure game, and its gameplay is structured similarly to other games in the Legend of Zelda series. As the game follows chronologically after the Wind Waker, the game is primarily divided into two major gameplay sections: sailing between islands and exploring the islands and their dungeons on foot. The game features 3D cel-shaded graphics with an overhead camera perspective, employs controls involving the console's touchscreen and microphone, and took advantage of the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection for online play until that service was discontinued in 2014, and I didn't get to use it.
Cry me a fucking river.
The player would be able to draw and make notes on the map on top of the screen with a stylus, while also controlling Link and his actions and charting the course of the SS Lineback across the open waters. Phantom Hourglass showed what the developers were capable of doing with the DS stylus in terms of top-down puzzle solving. It helps cement the fact that the DS was going to be home to console-quality experiences. Overall, it is a very familiar feeling entry to the Zelda series with a unique way to play it. So what are the pros to Phantom Hourglass? One, if you loved Wind Waker and the art style, you're gonna like Phantom Hourglass. Using the stylus as a primary way to play is quite unique. It's had a solid story and gameplay mechanics, and also a good soundtrack. What are the cons? Well, if you're not a fan of Toon Link, you're not gonna like the look of the game. Controls can be somewhat disorienting at first, and it takes time to get used to using the stylus as the primary method of gameplay. Blowing into the microphone. is yet another. I've said that. I think I'm pretty sure I said that on previous episodes. I fucking hate blowing or singing or whatever, screaming into the microphone. I thought that was one of the dumbest things Nintendo ever did. Some think it's unique. Some probably enjoyed it, but I fucking hate it. I hate blowing into the microphone.
Ain't nobody got time for that. Ain't nobody got time for that. Ain't nobody got time for that. Ain't nobody got time. Ain't nobody got time. Ain't nobody got time for that.
Some motions of the stylus that need to be fast and repeated can easily cause strain and fatigue of the hand. And the last con is the game is actually too easy. And that's all I got to say about that. Phantom Hourglass, number 6 on my list today. Moving right along with
5.
Oracle of Ages. Originally released in February 2001 in Japan, May 2001 in the US, and October 2001 in Europe, The Legend of Zelda Oracle of Ages is one of two Legend of Zelda titles released for the Game Boy Color, the other being Oracle of Seasons, both representing the 7th and 8th main installments of the series, respectively. Released near the end of the system's lifespan, Oracle of Ages and its counterpart were said to send the Game Boy Color out with a bang. I put quotes in that. In anticipation of the upcoming release of the Game Boy Color successor, the Game Boy Advance, the games exhibited special features, such as the Advance Shop, when played on the new handheld system. After completing one of the two games, they can be linked to form a single, linear plot, as opposed to two parallel ones, with an alternate ending. Game linking also unlocks extra content, such as new items. The game is named after its central character, Nehru, Oracle of Ages, and the element that is manipulated by Link in the game, the gauges. There was also a Nintendo 3DS Virtual Console release as well. Both titles were from Capcom's flagship, and at times, they feel like Capcom games. Interestingly enough, actually, Capcom wanted to remake the OG, The Legend of Zelda, and instead this is what they came away with, the Oracle games, Ages and Seasons. They both are directed by Hidemaro Fujibayashi and produced by Noritaka Funemitsu, and the music was composed by Minaku Adachi and Kiyohiro Sada. The story. Link, having been sent from Hyrule to Liburna by the power of the Triforce, awoke in Liburna almost immediately after stumbling upon Impa, who was besieged by a group of Octoroks. Unknown to Link, Impa had fallen into the clutches of the evil sorceress of shadows, Varan. This allowed her to trick Link into moving a secret barrier that obstructed her goal to possess the Oracle of Ages, Nehru. In full view of Link and Nehru's bodyguard, Ralph, Varan quickly possessed Nehru and began to utilize her newfound power of controlling time, traveling to the past and beginning her plan to bring untold sorrow to the world. Meeting with Liburna's guardian, the Maku Tree, Link learned that to defeat Varan, he would need the Essence of Time. However, the Essences, as their name suggests, were hidden throughout time, making them very hard for one person to obtain. By taking up the Harp of Ages in Nehru's house, Link was able to traverse time and search for the Essences throughout Liburna, all the while correcting the damage Varan had caused to the land, such as Symmetry Village. More than halfway into his journey, Link finally got a chance to rescue Nehru from Varan's clutches at Ambi's palace. However, as soon as he did, Varan possessed Queen Ambi. Using her new authority, Varan was almost successful in capturing Nehru, Link, and Ralph, but at the last second, Nehru used her power to return them all to the present. Gathering the last of the essences, Link prepared for the final showdown with Varan, but before he could go, Ralph ran off behind him so that he may slay Ambi, even knowing that with Ambi as his ancestor, her death would mean his death.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Varan proved too powerful for Ralph, knocking him out instead of killing him before moving on to fight Link. After fleeing Ambi and the powerful battle that followed, Link was able to best Varan once and for all. Varan laughed as she died, saying that her goal had been completed. The Flame of Sorrow lit. As Link, Nehru, and Ralph returned to their own time, a mysterious pair laughed, saying that the true evil had yet to arrive. The game falls under the era of light and dark within the fallen hero timeline. Yes, quite the story. The Oracle games probably have some of the best story as far as depth goes in the entire Zelda franchise. Gameplay. The gameplay of Oracle of Seasons and Ages is like that of The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening for the Game Boy, copying basic controls, graphics, and sounds. Like most Legend of Zelda games, exploration and combat take place from an overhead perspective. Link uses a sword for his primary attack, complemented by secondary weapons and items. Basic items such as bombs and the boomerang are common to both games. Other items are exclusive to one game, with a counterpart in the other. For example, the slingshot in Seasons and the seed shooter in Ages. They both shoot seeds, while the magnetic gloves in Seasons and the switch hook in Ages are used to access otherwise inaccessible areas. Unlike most Zelda games, a sword and shield are not always equipped when the player possesses them. They can be assigned like any other item into either of the two available slots. Most of each of the games is spent finding the eight essences hidden in dungeons, large, usually underground, areas containing enemies and puzzles. Each dungeon culminates with a boss that guards the essence. When not in a dungeon, Link explores the overworld, and in Seasons, the overworld consists of Holodrum and the subterranean world of Sabrosa, inhabited by the dwarf-like Sabrosian people. The two worlds are linked by several portals. In Ages, Link travels between present-day Labyrinna and the past, connected by time holes. In either game, some areas of one world are accessible only from portals from the other and vice versa. Holodrum, Sabrosa, and Labyrinna contain optional side quests and upgrades for Link and his equipment. One such side quest is ring collecting. Rings provide Link with various bonuses and abilities, such as improved defense. Other rings have no practical use whatsoever, such as rings that weaken Link's attack or defense, or transform Link into an enemy creature. Another side quest is the optional trading game, in which Link receives and delivers special items to certain people throughout the land. Once completed, Link receives an upgraded sword. In both games, there are many circumstances when a previous item can be upgraded into a more useful item. The latter three dungeons in both games will hold a more powerful version of an item received earlier in the game. Both the sword's offensive power and the shield's defensive abilities can be upgraded twice. The central item of Oracle of Seasons is the Rod of Seasons. By standing on a stump and swinging the rod, Link can change the season and affect his surroundings. For example, to cross a body of water, Link can change season to winter and walk on the ice. Changing the season to summer causes vines to flourish, which Link can use to scale cliffs. When Link obtains the rod, he initially cannot use it. During the game, Link visits four towers that house the four spirits of the seasons. Each tower Link visits allows him to switch to an additional season. In Oracle of Ages, the central item is the Harp of Ages, which Link uses to manipulate time and travel between the past and the present. In the course of the game, Link learns three tunes to play on the harp. The Tune of Echoes activates time portals at fixed locations. The Tune of Currents enables Link to travel from the past to the present without a time portal. And the Tune of Ages allows Link to switch between the two time periods at almost any location on the map. So what are the pros of Ages? Well, it's got that classic Zelda gameplay style. It also has solid mechanics and simple enough controls. Thirdly, it feels and sometimes looks like a Capcom game, which is not a bad thing. It also has a fair amount of puzzle solving, and the titles can be replayed in reverse order to increase replayability. So, if you didn't know that, yes, you can play Ages first, then Seasons, and then when you're done, you can start a whole new game and play Seasons first, and then Ages. What are the cons? Well, it's more of the same Zelda classic gameplay that we've had since A Link to the Past. The audio seems overdramatic. Also, for a handheld game, it's not the best audio in a Zelda series. There's not enough focus on action in Oracle of Ages. And aside from the audio, the soundtrack overall could be better. doesn't have the best music. So that is Oracle of Ages from the Legend of Zelda series, coming in at number 5. So as we get into the next one, can you guess what it might be? Oracle of Seasons. To number 5, obviously, it's interchangeable. So insert what you just heard in your ear holes here. Seasons is still its own game as well, since the two titles offer enough differences in experience that I personally would have to consider them their own separate entry/game. I would say they are so equally balanced between the two that their positions on my list could be interchangeable. For the first time ever, two titles that are equal and interchangeable. The story for Seasons, not as long as Ages, opens with the same Oracle of Ages, Link riding a horse. He spies a castle on the horizon, goes inside, and is sent by the Triforce to help a land being ravaged by the ruthless General Onyx. Link is teleported to the land of Holodrum after a bit of exploring. He discovers a traveling troupe. After hanging around and dancing with the troop's main attraction, Din, the sky becomes dark and General Onyx strikes. In the ensuing chaos, Din, revealed to be the Oracle of Seasons, gets kidnapped, taken to Onyx's mountain fortress, and imprisoned inside of a crystal. As a result, the Temple of Seasons falls into the earth, and the seasons of the land begin to become erratic. Link embarks on a quest to save Din and restore order. The young hero learns from Makutri that in order to penetrate to the center of Onyx's fortress, he needs to collect 8 essences of nature. While in the process of visiting the dungeons, Link spies a shady character moving in the weeds. He sneaks by her, and the girl disappears. After some exploration, he uncovers a strange-looking portal. Stepping on it, he is teleported to the lava-hot underground land of Sabrosia. Looking to his left, he sees the missing Temple of Seasons. Taking the Rod of Seasons that he borrowed from the temple itself, he learns seasons from the temple that become useful in his quest to retrieve the 8 essences of nature. After finishing the last of the dungeons and destroying Onyx, and his evil dragon alter ego Din is released, and the seasons become regular once again. However, the adventure is far from over. The Flame of Destruction is already lit by the destruction Onyx caused. Observing Link from afar, a mysterious pair laughs, saying that true evil has yet to arrive. The adventure carries on in a linked game of Oracle of Ages, or a linked game of Seasons if Ages is played first. The gameplay, well, rinse and repeat from Ages, with a little bit more focus on the action-adventure element of the titles here. I kind of broke it down. Again, just rewind. So, skipping all that, for this time around, what are the pros? Well, they all share pretty much the same pros as the last one. It's classic Zelda gameplay. It's got solid mechanics and simple enough controls. It feels and sometimes looks like a Capcom game. It's got a solid focus on the action-adventure aspect, and the titles can be replayed in reverse order to increase replayability. What are the cons? More of the same. Again, since Link to the Past. The audio seems overdramatic for handheld title, the soundtrack as well, it could be better, and for this one, not enough focus on puzzles. So, that's why they're interchangeable, perfectly balanced, as two titles that kind of link together, pun intended, as one continuous game/story. But, yes, the Oracle games at 5 and 4, doesn't matter the number, that's where they are on my list today. All right, getting into the final 3 Legend of Zelda handheld titles today.
3!
The Minish Cap.
Hey.
Minish Cap is another Capcom flagship slapper and was released in November 2004 in both Japan and Europe, and in the US in January 2005 for the Game Boy Advance. It is the 12th main installment of the franchise, and like most other titles in the series, the Minish Cap features the fully explorable land of Hyrule, although it can be viewed from the eyes of a human or the eyes of a Minish, a race of tiny people in an alternate form that Link can transform into. The game is the first in the story surrounding the Four Sword and features Vaadi as the game's main villain. However, unlike the multiplayer focus of the other games in the series, the Minish Cap retains the original form of exploration and dungeons as seen in A Link to the Past, Oracle of Seasons, and Oracle of Ages, as well as returning characters and game mechanics such as Milan and the Spin Attack. New features include fusing kinstones and shrinking to the size of a Minish. The game was directed by Hidemaro Fujibayashi and produced by Kaiji Inafune. Music was composed by Mitsuhiko Takano. The story. The Minish, who are also referred to as the Picori by Hylians, are a race of tiny creatures that bestowed a young boy with a green garment, a sword, and a shining golden light to drive back the darkness many years before the game is set. There are three types of Minish: town, forest, and mountain. The quest begins when Link is chosen by the king of Hyrule to seek the help of the Picori after Vaadi, searching for the Light Force, has destroyed the Picori Blade, releasing evil monsters into Hyrule, and petrified Princess Zelda. Link was chosen only because children can see the Picori. Soon into the voyage, he finds and rescues Ezlo, a strange being who is a living green cap with a bird-like head. Ezlo joins him, having Link wear him as he cannot move around as fast as Link can, and can allow Link to shrink to the size of the Minish. Although it is not revealed at first, he and Vaadi are actually Minish, aka Picori. Ezlo explains to Link that he is a renowned sage and craftsman, and Vaadi his apprentice. But Vaadi became corrupt by the madness and hatred of men and took a magic that Ezlo had made for the people in Hyrule. The hat grants any wish made by the bower, and Vaadi had wished to become a powerful sorcerer. Vaadi then turned his old master, who had tried to stop him, into his current hat form. With the help of Ezlo, Link retrieves the Four Sword elemental artifacts and brings them to the Elemental Sanctuary, which is also the gateway between Hyrule and the Picori homeland. There, he uses them to turn the Picori Blade, restored by the Picori, into the Four Sword, capable of defeating Vaadi. After Link restores the Four Sword, Vaadi turns Hyrule Castle into Dark Hyrule Castle, the final dungeon in the game. Link fights Vaadi just before he can drain Zelda of all the Light Force hidden within her, which would have killed her in the process. Link defeats Vaadi after engaging in a fight that consists of Vaadi changing into monstrous forms. When Link and Zelda flee from the collapsing castle to the Elemental Sanctuary, they are once again confronted by Vaadi, who changes form for the final battle of the game. After Vaadi is defeated, Ezlo returns to his original form. He takes the recovered Kappa Wishes that he created and gives it to Zelda, and helps her combine the Light Force energy in her with the power of the Cap, granting her a wish for the people that had been cursed by Vaadi to be cured, the castle to be turned back to normal, and the monsters that were released into Hyrule to no longer exist. The hat overflows with the power of life, disappearing after the wish is granted. Ezlo gives Link a new hat that looks like Ezlo's hat form and tells Link he enjoyed traveling with him, then goes into the Elemental Sanctuary to go back to the Minish world, just before the door to the sanctuary closes. This title falls under the Force era within the Hylia and the Hero of Time timeline. Gameplay for the Minish Cap. Honestly, same old, same old. It doesn't bear repeating at this point. Overworld dungeons, obtain item in dungeon, defeat boss with said item. Oh, and there's also side quests as well. However, a gameplay mechanic, original to the Minish Cap, is the ability for Link to transform into quote-unquote Minish size, as we've said before, by using one of the many quote-unquote Minish portals, as we said before, scattered across Hyrule. While in Minish size, Link is the size of the tiny Minish race. Take a drink. You know what? Rewind this episode. Go grab a beer or something else. Take a drink every time I say Minish. Minish Or how about Picori or Vadi?
This is so nuts. I mean, listen to what you're saying. It's paranoid delusion. It's really sad. It's pathetic.
You know what? Don't do that. You're going to black out. Anyway, so while in miniature size, Link is the same size as the tiny miniature race, and it changes the perspective on the way the player can interact with the world. It requires them to shift from minish to human in order to navigate the environment, avoid obstacles, and solve puzzles. For example, to minish Link, squares of tall grass are giant walls, and shallow puddles are giant lakes, whereas small structures and entire temples and cracks in the ground that human Link can only walk over are holes that Minish Link can drop down. Enemies that would otherwise be easy to defeat also become dangerous giant counterparts, such as regular Choo-Choo, which is the boss of the first dungeon and is fought while Link is in Minish size. The game's overworld is a map of the Kingdom of Hyrule, and its center is Hyrule Town. The town acts as the player's main safe space from the monster-infested overworld, allowing them to collect rupees, gather equipment, play games at entertainment establishments to gain prizes, begin and progress side quests, and interact with the citizens. Throughout the game's various story and side quests, Hyrule Town is also utilized as an on-and-off dungeon of sorts that Link must navigate interchangeably in his human and minish size. In the overworld and in the dungeons, the game replaces the traditional item interface of the handheld Zelda games with pictures associating items or actions with buttons, similar to item interface in 3D titles like Ocarina of Time and the Wind Waker. The Minish Cap introduces three new items, the Mole Mitts, the Gust Jar, and the Cane of Pocky. I say Pocky. I don't know if it's Pocky or Pachi. I say Pocky. It just sounds more Japan than Pachi. I don't know. The Mole Mitts allow Link to dig through dirt barriers to explore new areas. The Gust Jar can suck in nearby items and obstacles, and can be used to suck up certain enemies and fire them as projectiles. And the Cane of Pocky can flip certain objects over and allow Link to launch himself out of holes in the ground. The game advances the combat system from previous handheld installments by allowing Link to learn new sword techniques throughout the game, some of which are techniques from previous games and some of which are new. As the game progresses, Link will collect elements that fuse with his sword, allowing him to make copies of himself using glowing floor panels, used to solve puzzles such as pushing large blocks or hitting multiple switches simultaneously. Also, there are kinstones. These are special artifacts which Link can find throughout his quest. Kinstone pieces are fragments of the medallion that are found throughout the course of the game, and if a player can find a character or object with a kinstone piece, which is indicated by a thought bubble above their heads, the player can try to fuse their kinstone piece with one of their own to make a match. If a successful fusion is made, something will occur somewhere within the game's world, including the placement of treasure chests, access to secret areas, and certain events which occur among certain characters. While many kinstone fusions are optional, some fusions, such as those using golden kinstones, are necessary to advance the story. What are the Minish Cap pros? Well, number one, it's an improvement from Capcom over the Oracle titles. Also, it features the closer-to-the-ground camera, which gives it a better, more detailed perspective of the world. It's also got some of the best dungeon gameplay of all the handheld titles. Lastly, it's got an outstanding soundtrack, and it even features a sound test. The sound test is the only time a handheld Zelda title features a sound test. The cons? Well, by this point, it's too classic. Same Zelda with a unique gimmick on gameplay. And the dungeons may also be too long for some people. Though, another con is overall, the game is pretty short. And also lastly, the Kinstone system gets pretty repetitive. That is the Minish Cap, coming in at number 3 on my list today.
2.
Link's Awakening. released for the Game Boy in June 1993 in Japan, August 1993 in North America, and December 1993 in Europe, The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening is the fourth main installment of the Legend of Zelda series. It is the first title in the series to be released on a handheld system, and the only Zelda title of the original Game Boy system. Since its release, Link's Awakening has been popular among fans and critics within the entirety of the franchise. In 2009, Guinness World Records even named it the 42nd most influential video game of all time. A colorized update, titled Link's Awakening DX, was released for the Game Boy Color in 98, and during a Nintendo Direct on February 13th, 2019, an eponymous remake of the game was announced for Nintendo Switch. The remake was released on September 20th, 2019, prompting fans to want remakes of the original Zelda game and the Oracle titles as well. The game was developed by Nintendo EAD, directed by Takashi Tezuka, and produced by Shigeru Miyamoto. Music was composed by Kazumi Tataka, Minako Hamano, and Kazui Ishikawa. The story of Link's Awakening. After the events of A Link to the Past, Link travels by ship to other countries to train for further threats. A storm destroys his boat at sea, and he washes ashore on Koholint Island, where he is taken to the house of Turin by his daughter Marin. She is fascinated by Link and the outside world and tells Link wishfully that if she were a seagull, she would leave and travel across the sea. After Link recovers his sword, a mysterious owl tells him that he must wake the Windfish, Koholint's guardian, in order to return home. The Windfish lies dreaming in a giant egg on top of Mount Tamaranch, and can only be awakened by the 8 instruments of the Sirens. Link proceeds to explore a series of dungeons to recover the 8 instruments. During his search for the 6th instrument, Link goes to the ancient ruins. There he finds a mural that details the reality of the island, that is merely a dream world created by the Windfish. After this revelation, the owl tells Link that this is only a rumor, and only the Windfish knows for certain whether it's true. Throughout Koholint Island, nightmare creatures attempt to obstruct Link's quest for the instruments, as they wish to rule the Windfish's dream world. After collecting all 8 instruments from the 8 dungeons across Koholint, Link climbs to the top of Mount Tamaranch and plays the Ballad of the Windfish. This breaks open the egg in which the Windfish sleeps. Link enters and confronts the last evil being, a nightmare that takes the form of Ganon and other enemies from Link's past. Its final transformation is Deathl, a cyclopean dual-tentacled shadow. After Link defeats Deathl, the owl reveals itself to be the Windfish's spirit, and the Windfish confirms that Koholint is indeed all a dream. When Link plays the Ballad of the Windfish again, he and the Windfish awaken. Koholint Island and all its inhabitants slowly disappear. Very dark shit. Very dark shit, by the way. For such a lighthearted-looking game, it's very dark shit. Link finds himself lying on his ship's driftwood in the middle of the ocean with the Windfish flying overhead. The player did not lose any lives during the game. Marin is shown flying after the ending credits finish. The game falls under the era of light and dark within the Fallen Hero timeline. Gameplay. Like most other Zelda games up to this point and beyond, you know the drill. Take a Link to the Past and put it in handheld mode. Dungeons steadily become larger and more difficult and feature nightmare boss characters that the player must defeat, taking different forms in each dungeon and getting harder to defeat each time. Link's Awakening was the first overhead perspective Zelda game to allow Link to jump. This enables side-scrolling sequences similar to those in the earlier Zelda 2 Adventure of Link game. A little fun tidbit from the gameplay is that Link may steal items from the game's shop, but doing so changes the player's character's name to Thief for the rest of the game and causes the shopkeeper to knock out the thief upon re-entry of the shop. Link's Awakening is the first Zelda game to include a trading sequence minigame. The player may give a certain item to a character, who in turn then gives the player another item, and then the player then trades it with someone else, and so on and so forth. It also is the first game in the Zelda series in which the A and B buttons may be assigned to different items, which enables more varied puzzles and item combinations. Other series elements originating in Link's Awakening include fishing and learning special songs on the Ocarina. The latter mechanic is central, of course, to Ocarina of Time. And, you know, if you love A Link to the Past, you'll like Link's Awakening. That being said, what are the pros? Well, it's a fine follow-up to A Link of the Past. Like I said, it's A Link of the Past in handheld form, which is not a bad thing. At the time, it was a groundbreaking handheld title in terms of grandiose gameplay, visuals, and sound. It has a great soundtrack, and the game controls fairly well. What are the cons? The game is monochrome, and it's hard to play in the dark as well, if you're playing on original hardware, that is. The game is relatively short overall, and players may not like having to switch around items. Now, of course, that is if you're new to the series, if you're used to it but never did play Link's Awakening, you're going to be used to that. But that is that. Link's Awakening, number 2 on my list today. Here we go. We're getting into it. Finally, the last one. Ain't that right?
Yeah! Jesus fucking Christ, it's about time!
One.
A Link Between Worlds. Released in Europe and the US in November 2013, and Japan in December 2013, The Legend of Zelda: A Link Between Worlds is the 17th main installment of the Legend of Zelda series. It is the first Zelda title developed specifically for the Nintendo 3DS in an indirect sequel to A Link to the Past, featuring the same version of Hyrule but new characters and gameplay elements. The game was developed by Nintendo EAD, directed by Hiromasa Shikata, and produced by Eiji Aonuma. Music was composed by Ryu Nagamatsu. Story. Link, the apprentice of a blacksmith, goes to deliver a sword to the captain of Hyrule Castle, only to encounter a mysterious figure named Yuga, who transforms a descendant of one of the Seven Sages, Ceres, into a painting. After being knocked out during the fight, the merchant named Ravio finds Link and gives him a bracelet in exchange for him being allowed to stay in his home. And he tells him to report what had happened to Princess Zelda. After going to Hyrule Castle, Zelda gives Link the Pendant of Courage and instructs him to seek out the Pendants of Power and Wisdom to gain the power of the Master Sword. Along the way, Link encounters Yuga again and is turned into a painting. But Ravio's bracelet protects Link from Yuga's spell and gives him the ability to merge with walls and move around as a painting. After finding the other pendants and obtaining the Master Sword, Link returns to Hyrule Castle, where he witnesses Yuga transform Zelda into a painting. Link pursues Yuga through a dimensional crack, arriving in the twisted, decayed kingdom of Lorule. There, Yuga uses Zelda and the descendants of the Seven Sages, who he had trapped inside paintings, to revive and fuse with Ganon, obtaining the Triforce of Power in the process. Just then, Link is assisted by Lorule's ruler, Princess Hilda, who traps Yuga in magic bonds. Hilda instructs Link to find and rescue the Seven Sages, who have been scattered across Lorule, to gain the Triforce of Courage. With help from Ravio, Link accomplishes this and returns to Lorule Castle, where he discovers Hilda taking the Triforce of Wisdom from Zelda. Hilda reveals that Lorule fell into ruin after her ancestors destroyed their Triforce. Deciding that she needed Hyrule's Triforce to restore her kingdom to its former glory, she arranged the events of the game so Link would bring it to her. Hilda attempts to use Yuga to obtain the Triforce of Courage from Link, but Yuga betrays her and turns her into a painting, stealing the Triforce of Wisdom for himself. With Zelda's help, Link destroys Yuga and restores Zelda and Hilda from their painting forms. As Hilda feels bitter over the loss, Ravio, revealed to be Link's counterpart, convinces her that stealing Hyrule's Triforce isn't the right way to save Lorule, having secretly sought out Link to help her see the light. After Link and Zelda return to Hyrule, they use the Triforce to restore Lorule's Triforce and bring Lorule back to its full glory. With his quest completed, Link returns the Master Sword to its resting place once more, And this game falls under the Era of Light and Dark within the Fallen Hero timeline as well. A Link Between Worlds gameplay features traditional 2D top-down gameplay as seen in the early Zelda games, and unlike the previous Nintendo DS handheld games, Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks, the top screen shows the main game, while the bottom screen shows various game options and inventory features. It allows access to the map, a rupee count, item buttons, the inventory, and gear, which provides an overview of Link's sword, armor, and main items. The touchscreen is comparable to that of Ocarina of Time 3D with enhanced map features, such as zooming, placing location marks, real-time tracking of Link's position, etc., etc. An energy gauge that regenerates over time also appears, this time used for every item in the game, even replacing collectible bombs and arrows. Additionally, after Link meets Irene, he can call her at any time with a button on the screen. The A button controls basic actions like transforming and talking, B is dedicated to the sword, and Y, and later X, will use items. The right trigger raises the shield. The D-pad can shift the camera in certain areas as well. A Link Between Worlds is non-linear compared to many previous Zelda games, including its direct predecessor, A Link to the Past. This is accomplished via an item rental system, which allows Link to temporarily use or permanently buy most items from the game, provided he has enough rupees to pay for them. Because of this, most key items are no longer found in dungeons, but rather available through Ravio's shop, and if Link loses all his hearts while renting items, they will be returned to the shop, forcing him to re-rent them. Purchasing items, on the other hand, is far more expensive, but allows Link to keep items and to upgrade them via Mother Miami. Also, one of the game's major new abilities is wall merging, which is tied both to the plot and used heavily as a gameplay element. The ability can be used to cling to and move along walls, fit through crevices, and access Lorule, among other functions. Wall merging depletes the energy gauge and thus cannot be used indefinitely. When Link merges with a wall, he resembles a hieroglyphic sketch, as do other characters who have been transformed into paintings. But what makes Link Between Worlds truly unique? The dungeons can be done in any order, and items can be purchased to help solving those dungeons. It's a very open-ended experience, which allows for clever routing, speedrunning, and replayability. There are so many collectibles to uncover, and so much to explore. These are all the reasons as to why I consider it the finest Zelda handheld title, and one of the best entries in the entirety of the series. So what are the pros? It's got great graphics and audio enhancements over its handheld predecessors. It's got an outstanding soundtrack. The wall merging mechanic is unique and fun to utilize. The core and traditional gameplay elements are the best in the series with the open-ended experience. It's got great puzzle mechanics and they don't feel tired and old. And lastly, it has some of the best dungeons thanks to the wall merging mechanic. The cons? None. I honestly don't see any cons, other than some may feel like it's all been done before, and it has to an extent, but there is enough fresh new ideas incorporated into the game that it just doesn't feel that way to me, in my opinion. So therefore, I don't feel like A Link Between Worlds has any cons, and therefore, it is number one on my list of Zelda handheld titles on this episode of the Retro Rankings Podcast. So that's going to do it, but before we go, it's time for Portorota's player pro tip of the day.
Oh, yeah.
So what is the player pro tip of the day? It could be a number of things. It could be a legitimate pro tip to any one of the game titles that I just referenced in the top seven list on today's episode. It could kind of be a good thing or a bad thing, somewhere in between, you know, somewhere in the middle. And the bad is it could be complete and utter waste of your time. So what's it going to be today? Is it going to be a good, solid pro tip? Is it going to be a piece of shit? Or is it going to be somewhere in the middle?
All right, now that's exactly what I'm talking about. How come birds want to get inside the house so bad, eh? Well, they tired of all the blue sky, all the freedom, the wide open spaces. You know, birds hitting windows is like people getting married. That was the same bird. Now that kind of logic is impressive, isn't it? Huh? You know what I think? I think we need something there to distract them. Something that'll make the bird stop before they even get to the window. I'm thinking bird feeder. Make sure you hang it outside.
And that was today's Portorota's player pro tip of the day. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode. I want to thank all you listeners for joining me out there. If you want your one-stop shop for everything Potation Rotation and Retro Rankings podcast, please visit www.potationrotation.com. There you're going to find the links to the YouTube channels, which also includes Potation Rotation reviews, the current episode of the Retro Rankings podcast, in case you don't want to listen to it on the plethora of platforms that are out there for your podcast enjoyment, and also our links to Patreon. And there's also a new merchandise link, by the way, up at top. You can buy some t-shirts, some hats, some shower curtains, some bath mats, some stickers, maybe some socks and some hot pants. I mean, whatever floats your boat. I appreciate any kind of support that you give Potation Rotation LLC. If you want to email me anything, you got any problems with my rankings, you want to chime in, email me at potationrotation@gmail.com, and I will read your shit on a later episode. And lastly, I would appreciate a ranking. If you could give a vote of confidence to the Retro Rankings podcast, a review, wherever you're listening, I would greatly appreciate that as well. Again, thanks for joining me on today's episode. And I'll see you guys in a couple more weeks for lucky episode number 13 of the Retro Rankings podcast. See you guys later. Bye-bye.